Every successful person got there by going through tough times. Success is a hard-ass teacher who likes to knock you around along that journey. You know, it takes real guts to not give up and keep going. We'll hear stories about failures and how these leaders flipped the script to create success. I'm John Schultz. Join me and let's discover how success is never really overnight. So welcome to the John Schultz podcast. Very excited today. I have a great guest, a friend, a golfing buddy, all sorts of good things. His name is Chris Giammo, and he is currently the executive vice president of TD Bank Group and serves as head of commercial banking. So he leads TD Bank's commercial banking businesses throughout the U.S., including small business through middle market segments. He's responsible for TD's treasury management system and products and leads what I think is so important today, the internal technology and innovation programs. Everything's changing so rapidly. I'm sure your head spins from time to time. But welcome, Chris. Thanks for being here.
No, thank you, John. It's great to get spend some time with you today.
Absolutely.
Looking forward to it.
Yeah, this is good. So listen, your career has been amazing, but it always starts back when we're really young and, you know, all of our creativity's coming out and, you know, we form as we're a young child. So my first question to you is, you know, where'd you originally grow up? And like, how would you describe yourself growing up as a young Chris?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. You know, I know you're a Jersey guy. So I grew up in North Jersey in a small town called Hasbrook Heights. You know, I don't know how creative I was as a kid, but, you know, I grew up in a kind of a traditional Irish-Italian household. You know, I had one younger brother. And I would say, you know, some of the things at a young age that really formed me, I always played sports. I was an athlete, you know, kind of grew up in somewhat of a strict household. You know, you had to do your homework, you had to do your chores. You weren't staying in bed on the weekends. You were going to get up, you were going to help, you know, help dad with some chores out in the yard or in the house. And you had to do that, really. So it was a lot about, you know, hard work and family and friends, and it was that type of environment.
So did you rebel against that, or was that something that actually you learned was something you took to?
I'm sure I always rebelled. You know, rebellion wasn't so tolerated. So I would say, you know, you learned how to live with it. And, you know, at the end, I think it's like anything in life, you know, and I have two sons now that are 24 and 21. I don't know when, but at some point in my life, I probably looked back and appreciated that type of environment much more than I did when I was a kid. And I would say, you know, and I talk a lot, you know, to executives and leaders and people, I really think that work ethic and discipline and routine really helped form, you know, who I am today and how I, you know, embody some of that even in, even, you know, 33 years later in my banking career.
I totally agree. It is funny. Like when you're going through things, you don't realize how you're being molded, right? And, you know, a lot of the things that we do rebel against usually are the things that are greatest, you know, attributes, because we had to get through it. And it was a challenge, and it wasn't something we really wanted to do, but we felt and got confident from it. So who, I mean, obviously you had a great family upbringing, but who were some of your role models? Were there certain people that, you know, shaped you? You played sports. Was it a coach? Was it your parents?
You know, I think it was a lot of people at different stages. I would have to say, you know, my parents. You know, I you know, we didn't grow up with a lot, but they were very committed to my brother and I, and our, whether it was school, sports. So I felt like I always had that support. And I think that discipline early on, you know, my dad said something to me when I was really young. He said, listen, I don't care what you do in life, but truly look in the mirror and say, did you give it your all?
Yep.
And if you got a job, get there early, be the first to get there and the last to leave. And it sounds kind of simple, but I would say, no matter what you do, you could probably outwork 50% of everybody. I mean, that's where the bar kind of starts. And as long as you try your best, you're focused and disciplined, you know, the other stuff kind of comes, right? And you'll make some mistakes along the way, but you learn from those mistakes. And that's where that passion kind of comes in. And it dovetails just that basic approach. And it goes into sports too, right? It's an athlete's mentality. But I don't think you need to be an athlete to have that type of discipline and focus and work ethic either.
No, I agree. What do you feel, like, what were some of the challenges you had growing up, right? Because listen, yeah, you had a very supportive family. You know, sports gives you a unique experience as a young person, you know, accountability, camaraderie, a feeling of being part of something. But what would you say were some of the challenges that helped mold you and strengthen you when you were younger?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if there were as much challenges as well as maybe objectives and kind of goals, you know. And, you know, I would say, you know, I knew at an early age, I grew up in a small town. And, you know, that was great. But you really went from kindergarten through high school with almost the same 80 to 100 kids.
Yeah.
So it was a small town. And I went to public school from kindergarten through eighth grade and still have friends to this day that are my dearest friends from that. And that was, I think, some of the real formative years. You know, this is back in the late 70s and 80s where, you know, you rode a bike to school, you got home from school, you went to practice, you played in the yard with your friends, you had to get home before dark, you ate dinner, you did your homework, and you got up and did it all over again. So, you know, I think one thing, and I don't know if it was a challenge, but, you know, something triggered and there were some Catholic schools that were larger in the area. And I was a wrestler and, you know, I was interested in wrestling and I was okay at it. And I wanted to challenge myself and said, hey, I love my formative years, but I think there's more out there. And what if I went to a larger school and met different people? So I would think, you know, deciding to do that and then my parents supporting me, I went to Paramus Catholic High School in Bergen County, which really for me, again, going from the same 80 kids that I went from kindergarten through eighth grade and then getting into a class with 500 kids, 400 kids from all different areas, right, and walks of life, that was a little bit daunting. Like, okay, all right, now I'm here, you know, and you have to make new friends and find your own way and stuff. So I don't know if that was a challenge as much as an experience, but I think it was a good experience.
Yeah, listen, most people will not do that, right? I mean, you literally uprooted yourself and put yourself in a situation that you had to culminate new friends and new experiences. That's and what year did you do that?
That was 1984.
Wow. Wow. Good for you. I don't know many people that would do that. I know that I would have trouble with that. So, all right. So here you are, you're going, you know, sports, school, seems like you had a great, you know, early years. What, you know, here you are a titan of banking now, right? But what were some of your career aspirations growing up and how did they evolve? And, you know, are you doing what you thought you wanted to be doing?
You know, I tell, you know, funny story, but I think it goes back to, you know, just work and work ethic. So, you know, I was probably 11 when I got my first job sweeping the sidewalk in front of a veterinarian clinic that was up the block, you know, and I turned that into sweeping for the funeral parlor that was down the block and, you know, making some money. And then whenever it snowed, we shoveled and we raked leaves. And, you know, that's just what we did at that point in time. And we turned it into a little bit of a business and we would pair up and you would have to pick somebody that, you know, could shovel and shovel well, because you made more money the more houses that you could do. But I think it was like I was in eighth grade and, you know, I was starting to cut my father's lawn, the house I lived in. And then I cut the neighbor's lawn and he had said, hey, you know, it's time you probably get a more full-time job in the summer. And, you know, there's a landscaper down the block You know, you can cut lawns. Why don't you go knock on his door and see if he needs any summer help? So, I'm a little kid. I'm in eighth grade. You know, it was a little intimidating to go knock on this stranger's door and say, hey, I live down the block. You know, I could maybe you're looking to hire anybody.
Right.
You know, so the first day, you know, the summer, I didn't go. My dad came home from work and said, hey, did you, how'd it go? Did you go down the block? I'm like, I didn't think he was home. You know, I didn't go. And he goes, well, you should go do that. You know, you get in front of it. The summer's here. Well, you know, next day I didn't do it. You know, third day, my mom, you know, said, you know, I really suggest that you go down there before your father comes home the third time and asks you again. And, you know, I'm 5'8 on a good day. So I was even smaller back then. And I was, knocked on the door, very timid. And, you know, this burly guy kind of answers the door and is like, who are you? And I'm like, you know, hey, I live down the block. I cut grass. You know, I see you have a landscaping company. You're looking for help. He looked at me, I guess I was 13. I was 13 years old. Yep. And he said, you know, do your parents know you're here? And I said, yeah, my dad told me to come. And he's like, all right, well, listen up. I'll give you a shot. You know, here's what I pay. Be here at 7 o'clock Saturday morning. And I was there Saturday morning, worked 12 hours. At the end of the day, I got paid cash for the day I worked. And he goes, okay, come back on Monday. And that was it. And I had that job literally from that eighth grade summer till I graduated college.
Wow.
And I worked, you know, for literally for 10 years, every summer, 6 days a week for the same guy. So you talk about influence and, you know, this is what he did. He had a landscaping company, but, you know, I spent more time with him than I spent with most people. And I think I learned a lot over those years, you know, and just, understanding discipline, sacrifice, hard work. Sometimes my friends who didn't have jobs, they were going to camp and they were going to things. And it wasn't like I was ever deprived. But, you know, I worked for the most summers for 50 hours, 60 hours a week for most of my childhood. But I always had money, helped me pay for college, helped me pay for some other things. And I probably learned as much, if not more, during those years about life, work and people.
Service, right? Being part of something, accountability, especially at a young age, right?
Accountability is the thing too, because over time, like if I didn't show up, he wouldn't be able to do all the yards that he was going to do because he relied on me. And, you know, you say accountability. I'm glad you said that because not like I couldn't take a day off, but if we had a big day, you know, and I went out on a Friday night, I knew I had to be there 7 a.m. the next day and be ready. Otherwise, it impacted him. And I think I learned, yeah, I was making spending money, right, for my pocket, making money to help pay for college. But this guy was supporting a family, a mortgage, a house. And this was not a, you know, large scale, you know, business. And I think I recognized the accountability and responsibility I had. And that meant something to me. To this day, I still talk to him too.
What's amazing too, because think about it, you can't be in the position you're in without that attitude. Like, look how many people that, you know, you help their lives, you know, flow, right? From all the different positions that you manage. So I think that's amazing. And I love it. I mean, I didn't go to camp either. I used to like push food town carts or I'd work at the track and valet. I always enjoyed like making my own money as well. And I sort of did enjoy that accountability. And, you know, I met so many people through it. So it's good. It's great. It's entrepreneurial, right? Because it's not your business, but you're adding to something, which is great. So you went to college. So when you're in college, and again, getting back to this question, right? Like banking, finance, like what drove you there? Like, is that something that came natural to you?
Yeah, not necessarily. You know, my dad was an accountant, so, you know, he was in the business world. So, you know, I think, you know, at a young age, at least in high school, you know, this was in the early 80s, right? So Wall Street was starting to evolve, and there was some sensationalism with, you know, with business careers and whatnot. So I think I knew I wanted to be in business. I didn't know what. And, you know, so in college, and that was always a focus. My parents were big on education. So it was, you know, I think my dad was really the first in his family to go to college. And, you know, and he went to school, you know, days and nights locally. And I was one of the first in my family to go away to college. And
wow, that's great.
You know, so I was an economics and finance, you know, major. So I knew I wanted to be in business. And when I graduated, you know, this was in 1992, you know, the economy wasn't that great back then. And it was kind of, you know, hey, let's get a job. My resume really consisted of landscaping. So it wasn't like I had a lot of practical experience. And I ended up getting a job with a bank in New York, which was in a management training program. But that wasn't until, and this is an interesting story too, you talk about life, how things form you, right? You know, the first couple interviews I went on, I got the interviews, and, you know, I went to University of Rhode Island, which is a good school. You know, it's not an Ivy League school. And, you know, I didn't have an MBA. You know, I wasn't able to have the time or afford that at the time. And the first couple of interviews I went to, you know, they looked at my grade, they looked at my experience, and pretty much unceremoniously said, I don't think this is for you. You know, I don't think we're the right fit for you. And it was a couple of banks, a couple of financial services firms. And then I did get an interview, you know, and one of the gentlemen that was interviewing me was kind of an older school guy, an Italian guy who had kind of made his way up to the top, so to speak. And he looked at my resume and he's like, landscaping, huh? You did that. It must have been hot in the summer when you were pushing that mower. What did you think about? And he really gravitated to that and then asked more about the family and the commitment to work. And his view was, I like that you worked hard. And he goes, if you take that approach to this training program, the sky will be the limit. So he really, I got a chance, I think, because the guy I was interviewing with ultimately was making the decision, kind of had a similar maybe upbringing or childhood and appreciated the qualitative parts that I had rather than the academic and the practical experience. And it goes back to the early things I learned about getting there early and leaving late. And that's how I approached that job. And I would say I did well in the program based on hard work, people skills, you know, working well with teams. And that was really the catalyst. It was the only job I got offered. And I did well in it, but it was really because of all the attributes and the things, experiences I had that were really not.
And what company was that?
That was at Bank of New York.
That's amazing. It's like, it's hilarious, right? Like we think like there's this plan on how things happen. Like everyone thinks, how do you get to that level? It's gotta be this perfect plan and everything's set up properly. And there's this roadmap where you almost didn't get a job, right? Like you almost weren't in banking. If he didn't, and you didn't show up to this person, you may have been in a whole nother industry. But
I will say, and I'm not vindictive in this way, but I will say that the one bank that dismissed me so quickly, you know, is an inferior competitor of ours today. So
the world's round. That's what happened.
The world is round.
All right. So you get this first job, and now you're in banking, and you know, obviously, any new job, we're trying it. We don't always know why we're, you know, if we're going to like it. What got you gravitated towards not only being in this job, but staying in banking? And then give us a little background of like what happened from there and how did you get to your next level?
Yeah. I would say the training program was fairly comprehensive. It was like, you know, back when, you know, banks and other firms had these holistic training programs. They were 12, 15 month programs, which really took, you know, college graduates and put them in various areas of the bank all around. So you had a little bit more of a holistic view of the industry.
Is that still today? Is that how it works today?
You know, these programs are fewer and further between now, you know, just because they are. But yes, that's fundamentally, that's how these programs kind of still work. And, you know, and I cleared more on the credit side of things, you know, being a credit analyst, underwriting within commercial banking, you know, of business loans that you would make to, you know, I know you're in the real estate world, whether they're real estate companies or operating companies, small businesses, and everything in between. So, you know, when I went and I was doing that, I was really intrigued and interested in saying, okay, here's this entrepreneur, right? And they have this company and I'm analyzing the financial statements to see if we can lend them money or capital so they can grow and run their business. And at times I was able, even as a young analyst, to join a relationship manager or somebody that was managing the relationship on a customer visit or a call. And I was fascinated how you learned about the business kind of from front to back, whether it was a manufacturing company, a servicing company, of, you know, anything of like, okay, I know what this end product looks like in the store, but wow, this is how this is manufactured or made. And I gravitated to it in the client side of things. And I did well at it, I would say, and made relationships. And someone that I was working with, and, you know, you talk about the world is round. This is interesting, too. It's probably maybe 10 years older than I was. So if I was 23, he was 33. And he was a relationship manager, and we had a good relationship. And he had left Bank of New York and went to another firm. And like a year later, he called me and said, hey, you know, there's an opening at this new bank I'm at. It was Core States Financial Group out of Philadelphia and South Jersey. And he goes, I think you'd be great for this. I think it's a promotion from where you are today. You should really go on this interview. And he was really pushing me on it. So I said, hey, you know, I've been at Bank of New York for a few years now, and maybe it was time at that young age. Sometimes you move around a bit to get to the next level. And I went on the interview. And the gentleman who was running that group, interestingly, you talk about mentors, is one of my mentors. And to this day, and that was 1994, to this day, he's one of my best friends. I don't think a week goes by that we don't talk to each other. And I was on that interview, and you talk about being authentic. I tell this story too. You know, he started like with a lot of formality, and he said, you know, listen, I want to ask some questions, some technical questions, and see how you respond. I said, okay. And he said, you know, how would you approach looking at a capitalized lease versus an operating lease? And, you know, according to FASB 149 or something like that. So I kind of looked at him, I tilted my head. I had no idea what FASB 149 was. And I said, well, I said, to be candid with you, I never heard of that before, but I said, I'm very resourceful and I'm the type of person who I'm not afraid to say what I don't know. And I'll do the research. I would find out and then do the work. And if I couldn't, then I would raise my hand and ask for help. And he looked at me and he smirked and he says, good answer, because there's no such thing as FASB 149. I want to see how you'd respond.
Oh, I love that. I love that.
If you would give me some BS answer. So he goes, you're going to be hired. Let's enjoy the lunch and get to know each other. So let's not worry. Put that aside. And he hired me. And he was probably one of the best bosses I ever worked for. And you talk about that moment, because I went there. And then First Union acquired Core States, which was at the time a very large bank. Now it's Wells Fargo. And, you know, I was in their corporate group at that point. You know, I've learned a lot more. I'm now dealing with more sophisticated middle market and large corporate type deals. And I grew, and then I ended up getting on the relationship coverage side versus underwriting. And that same boss who was running the broader division, wasn't my immediate boss, ended up leaving and going to a small entrepreneurial bank in South Jersey that was very small at the time to create kind of a middle market group. And he was able to take one person and he recruited me to go and I followed him.
And what bank was that?
And that was Commerce Bank.
That was it. That's the change of banking on its face, right?
And that's what TD ended up acquiring. And that was 1998. So that was 26 years ago. I made that change. And that bank, and, you know, we could talk more about some of those experiences, but from 1998 to 2008, that bank went from $5 billion in assets to 50. So it literally was, you know, a tsunami of organic growth and probably a 10-year experience that you couldn't get anywhere.
Listen, I mean, Commerce Bank, for people listening, was the first bank that made retail banking feel like other retail establishments that you would walk into. From a food, McDonald's, to any, before you didn't even want to walk into a bank. Like, it was like, you know, it's like they had your money and you almost were scared to ask for your money, right? The service level wasn't there. I remember they had the change machines. Like, they made a bank branch sort of fun, right? For like, which was unusual at the time.
So, you know, you look back and you piece these things together, right? And, you know, every career life, you know, has these seminal moments. But if it wasn't for my hard work and honesty of being not afraid to not know the answer to a question, I maybe wouldn't have gotten that job. That person turned out to be one of my, you know, most important mentors and now friends in my career. And if it wasn't there, I wouldn't be where I am today. I'm sure it would have taken a different turn one way or the other, but it wouldn't be, you know, what it is today. It was an interesting run.
I love it. You know, what's interesting is, you know, you seem like you were never afraid to make that move. It's almost like going back to your parents, forcing you to go ask the landscape person for a job, right? Like you had this inner strength as a young person to carry through your career and you weren't afraid to make a move. And, you know, if you look at Commerce, I mean, I can't imagine it was hyper growth, right? So, you know, using all your skills for managing people and growth. So talk about some of the challenges there. How many people were there when you got there and what position were you in?
Yeah. So, you know, you talk about, you know, confidence or willingness to, you know, take a chance, right? And do that because at this point in, you know, this was now moving to Commerce was 1998. So in that mid 90s, there was a lot of consolidation within banking. And there was this view that, you know, that there was only going to be a handful of large banks in the country and these small banks couldn't survive. And at that time, First Union was one of the stronger ones. So making a move from there, where I was gainfully employed on a great career path with kind of a plum desired type job, to take that risk and follow somebody to a small micro bank in South Jersey that at the time had less than 100 bank branches, $5 billion in assets, was a big risk. But at the time, it was more about I trusted the leader who was going there and, you know, and said to myself, hey, I think we can do what they're asking us to do. It may be a challenge, but I'd rather do that with someone I like and trust. And if it doesn't work out, maybe I can always come back. And at the end of the day, if they get taken over and we're good, you know, that bank will want to keep us as well. So we did it. And, you know, I think we underestimated at the time of where they were in their journey, particularly for what our mandate was to build the middle market bank. And, you know, you talk about setbacks and perseverance and, you know, something I always say to people, like I always say, you know, grit is more important than IQ, you know, and if you look at grit, it's really, I think, the combination of perseverance and passion There's a great book by Angela Duckworth called Grit. And if you haven't read it, people should read it. I think it tells a lot about successful people and people who could kind of move forward in that inner fortitude. But the first loan we were going to close, you know, the bank didn't even have an automated way to track interest rates on certain indices. Middle market loans at that time were being priced off of LIBOR, which was a published rate. We were at the closing table and the back office says, well, we don't have a LIBOR index. We can't do that. And I said, well, we have to figure a way to do it. So we actually had somebody in the back office that looked at the Wall Street Journal in the beginning and literally pulled the LIBOR rate and manually inputted it into the operational system.
Oh, my God.
So we had to actually look at from end to end, front to back, of what we really needed to serve some of these more upper-end commercial middle-market clients. So it didn't deter us. It actually motivated us to say, okay, we got a lot more work to do. How are we going to do this? And we did it. And we were successful, and the bank was incredibly successful, and it was growing at a rapid pace, brick by brick, customer by customer. And so, you know, throughout that journey, there was always some setback that you were kind of like, oh my God, like, how am I going to get up tomorrow and go do this again? But I think it was that perseverance, that resiliency, that will to succeed, and that really drove us. And I always said, at least for me, I was never afraid of hard work. And the reward of the positive outcome of that hard work is what drives certain people. And that's what really drove me, that we can work collaboratively, have a goal in mind, have all the support. And that organization did provide the support. We knew what our objectives were. We got the support we needed, and you just had to perform. That was an environment that made it easy, right? Because that's the way you win. When you all those things have to be connected.
The real estate footprint, right? The deposits, you know, making it a friendly place to want to put your money, a happy place to actually want to put your money. It was amazing. So you got it all the way to $50 billion, right? And then I guess TD eventually bought Commerce, right? Yeah. How long ago was that now?
Now it's, you know, it's 2008. You know, that Commerce, as I said, literally grew from $5 billion to $50 billion. I used to say it was like trying to change the tire on a moving car. Yep. That's how rapid, the growth was. And at that time, TD Bank, you know, was one of the largest banks in Canada. And a year or two earlier, made a very deliberate effort that was going to grow in the U.S. And that's where they were going to grow. You know, in Canada, there's only four or five major banks, you know, so if you're really going to have exponential growth, you're going to then move into Europe, the Caribbean, or the United States. And TD made a very deliberate strategic objective to grow in the U.S. And prior to Commerce, they had bought about another $50 billion bank in New England called Bank North. And that was their entree into the U.S. marketplace. And that was about 2006. So fast forward to 2008, they made a deal and acquired Commerce. And that's where those two organizations came together for the U.S. footprint. And at that time, I was an executive, a regional president, running kind of the metropolitan New York area for Commerce. And that's the role I had or kept, you know, when TD came in. And that was a great experience as well, as integrating, really it was almost a tri-party merger, because the Bank North deal was relatively new. Bank North, or TD Bank North at the time, and then Commerce Bank had to come together as one. And then we had the parent company in Canada. So, you know, what was smart about that is the organization didn't try and force one model onto any one area. They really took the best of everything that Bank North, Commerce, and TD Bank Group had to offer and bring it in to one culture.
So there wasn't a lot of redundancy, or was there?
There was some, but it was really a revenue synergistic deal rather than a cost cut.
Yeah.
Because I think if I look at our overlap, you know, Bank North had the New England market, really Northern Connecticut up through Maine, and Commerce had more of a mid-Atlantic, Southern Connecticut down to Florida, with some gaps in the Southeast, but really, you know, mid-Atlantic. So it gave a foundation, really a Maine to Florida East Coast bank, which at the time probably had close to 1,000 retail branches, we call them stores, and a $100 billion asset foundation to build off of. And from that, you know, the bank continued to deploy an organic growth strategy, some of the muscle Commerce had, because Commerce really grew organically,
yeah.
Very little, if any, almost no acquisitions. And Bank North was the culmination of like 60, 70 bank mergers. So it took the best of an organic and inorganic growth model, brought it together, and deployed both, which made it really formidable. And that's really, if you fast forward 16 years later to where we are today, is the, you know, seventh largest bank, let's say, in the country, depending how you count, of who we are, of, you know, buying banks, buying, you know, portfolios or capabilities, as well as organically growing.
So this seems like the first job you weren't dragged into something else. Yes, a merger, an acquisition, but did your group stay together? Did the person that you said you trusted implicitly also stay? And how was that whole transition for you, being that this is a much bigger thing now? This is not an entrepreneur as entrepreneurial.
Yeah, no, that one mentor and boss had left a little bit before the TD came in to do something truly entrepreneurial. But a lot of the colleagues and people that we hired along the way all stayed and are still here today. And I think, the one thing, you know, again, I went back to what made Commerce successful, what makes TD successful. TD was very focused on building a world-class franchise in the U.S. So the objective was real clear, top to bottom, the top of the house, from the board to the executive team. That was the mandate. That was the objective. And then they enabled the teams to go execute and go do that. And part of the model and the brand was a customer-centric model. We are going to be, and we are, our logo is America's Most Convenient Bank. That's what we're going to do. We're going to put the customer at the center of everything we do and operate around that. And I think that's been a lot of our success and been why we've been able to retain a lot of executives and the people we've brought along the way, because you know, people want to work for something, you know, that's clear to them, right? And we've been a growth company, and I think that excites people as well.
It's great. All right, so from not knowing what FASB 149 meant, right, that it wasn't even a thing, to the head of commercial banking for TD Bank, $100 billion plus in assets, you know, what I love about you is, like, I've known you for a very long time, and you are who you are, and you care about people, you care about people's success, and you genuinely want to hear about what people are doing, which, you know, I'm harking back to where you said how, like, you know, you could learn about the manufacturing process and why you like going out and seeing customers, right? So here you are, middle market, small business. What was the challenges of being so big? Because it's big. I mean, like, you can't get away from it. And still having that Commerce, that feel of, like, why people loved the bank prior to them acquiring it.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a lot of things. You know, I think, you know, from a personal career journey, you know, I would say authentic leadership is incredibly important. You know, and I would say the big focus is, even when I look to executives on my team or people I've hired and worked with along the way, is, again, strong work ethic, honesty, integrity, and it's okay to make mistakes. Just own your mistake and try and get better for it. And I'll roll my dice and take my chances on those types of individuals and leaders versus somebody who's trying to, you know, snow you over and hide what they're doing and be individually focused. So, you know, teamwork and collaboration, that's important. And I also think for leaders, authentic leadership's important. And you said you are who you are, and that's fine. You got to be self-aware, right? You got to know your strengths. You got to know your weaknesses. And I also think showing some level of vulnerability helps bring people along and helps followership. So I don't know any other way. I don't know that I've done it purposely. That's just who I am. I think that's helped me and maybe held me back in some ways, but I'm always willing to learn. And I would say, and I say this to people and I challenge myself, intellectual curiosity. Be curious. Ask questions. Try and learn from people, colleagues, customers, partners, you know, anybody and anything. You never can stop learning and challenging yourself. And I know you too, John, for a long time. I know you're the same way. You're always curious. You're asking questions. But that's how you take the best of what people have and kind of incorporate it into what you're doing, but be true to who you are and don't try and be something you're not. Exactly. So I would say that helped a lot along the way. And you're right. You know, what I do today is very different and has a different set of challenges than, you know, what I used to do. And what I would say now is, you know, you have to rely on your team. And you can't be afraid to have people in the room. And I know I have. I look at my team. There's many people that are a lot smarter than I am or subject matter experts in certain areas where I'm not. And, you know, I learn from them. They learn from me. And collaboratively, that's how we execute and that's how we win. And, you know, what I'm probably most proud of is over the years, the team I've built, the leadership team I have today, is probably the best leadership team that I've had ever, that I've worked with. And I know that there's not one thing that we face that collectively we can't at least go address. We're not going to get it right every time, but we're going to get darn close. And if we don't get it right the first time, we're going to get it right the second time. So
it's why you wake up and go to work. I mean, the people, right? It's like, why do you like sports? Because you felt you were part of something. Everyone had roles that they had to achieve, and together you made magic happen, right? And I think business is the same thing. And learning, and I love the whole intellectual curiosity, because I think like if you don't learn something that day, it's a wasted day in my mind. So,
well, and you use a sports analogy, and I think it's so applicable. And again, you don't have to be an athlete to understand the analogy. You know, you look at any sport, right? You have a coach, that's your leader. You have a game plan, but what do you do in the off season? You practice, you focus, you put your game plan together. So what happens when you get into the game? Sometimes your game plan doesn't work. So what is there? There's timeouts, there's halftime. What do you do during those timeouts and halftime? You adapt to what's working or what's not working, and then you have to pivot and you leverage the entire team. And, you know, you may have to put different people in at different points in time in the game to achieve what you need. And I think in business, same thing. You know, your best strategy, if you can't execute against it, it may not work. And if you don't have the willingness to adapt your playbook when it's not working, you're never going to be successful. And you have to have that muscle to be able to go do that.
Yeah, and you have to, failure's good, right? You learn how it's not supposed to be. Then you move on and you try something else. Like, to me, it's the greatest learning lesson when you actually try something. You just get closer to where you're supposed to be. So, and talking about adapting, right? Like, we're in the most fast-paced technological AI revolution, whatever you want to put the name to it. And we're like, tech is in every company now. It's not like you're a tech company. We're all innovation companies now. So what are some of the trends that you think can significantly impact the future of banking and like, how are you preparing and, you know, how are you going to adapt to customer preferences being that a whole new generation is just like, we could see it now, like they're used to different things. They're just different than, you know, the generations before.
You know, I think it's a big deal. And it's something you have to be cognizant of. And we are in a cultural shift. So I would say in banking, which is probably accelerating fast now, but a little bit slower to follow consumer preferences. So if you think of the average consumer, they're really influenced by what I would call maybe big tech, like Amazon and Google and all of that type of ability to shop online, customize something, have it your way and have it now. You know, whether you go into anything that you do, right? And there's a generation now, even though all generations use it, because I even know my parents are using smartphones now and things and that they would never use. But there's a generation that doesn't know another way. And as they become the leaders, right, of businesses and the consumers that you want, you have to have that those types of self-serve capabilities, online, real-time abilities to do things. But you need to have all of it. So I would say you need your physical structure, a store, a bank branch still matters. But what you do in that store may be different today than what it was 20 years ago. It's more advice-based. It's more, you know, driving more complex products or services where now on your phone, you can accept the payment, make a payment, transfer money, move money, invest money, literally at a flick of a thumb on a smart device. So if banks in any company, in any industry, doesn't embrace that accelerated consumer preference and change on how they consume products, services, goods, do their day-to-day financial banking, saving, investing, you know, you're going to get left behind.
Yeah, Apple Pay, all of these, it really is so easy to transact today. And the easier someone makes it, the harder it's going to be for you to figure that out, right? Because you're just going to be challenged constantly on how you have to deliver services to people. All right. So my last question. So, you know, your role stands and extends beyond banking. You're also an executive sponsor of the TD Bank's Individual with Diverse Abilities Initiative, which I think is amazing. Could you tell us a little bit more about this? Because I know you. You're like a person that always wants to do good. So, I thought this was an amazing thing that you're doing.
Yeah, it's, you know, listen, diversity and inclusion is an important part of any organization, and it's incredibly important to us at TD Bank. And it's not just diversity of thought as well as diversity, whether it be race, gender, and individuals with disabilities. And this is something I kind of came into. Each executive on the team takes kind of one of the diverse pillars and sponsors it and works. You know, one of the things I learned, and it was amazing, until you see it, I met, and I didn't have anything to do with it. The bank did. I met this individual at one of our conferences, and he's blind. And I think he's been blind since birth. He was in his 30s, lived alone, independently, took a bus to work every day with a seeing eye dog. And interestingly, I asked where he worked, you know, what he did, and he was in one of our customer sales areas, phone sales. So I'm saying to myself, okay, you know, well, how's that work? And we had invested significant dollars in special equipment, computer equipment, that's voice activated because obviously, you know, he's blind and interfaces with a customer by, you know, his voice and hearing and it translating text into words. He's actually one of our best salespeople. in that from a customer service standpoint. So what it opened my eyes to is we have to look at these individuals and see through their disabilities, because on the surface, you would think, okay, this role is typically people on a computer typing, people on the phone, dialing and calling, looking at reports, and obviously that's challenging for somebody who's vision impaired. But it shows with the right equipment and technology that exists, the bank making that investment, whatever it was, which was significant, that individual is able to excel. And there was no limit to the possibility of what they can do. And I've kept a relationship with this executive, and we chat from time to time. And he's actually gone on to do other things within the organization. So I think it's things like that and working with organizations with people with disabilities that they're comfortable bringing them their true selves to work and, you know, being able to perform at all different levels despite some of those disabilities that you would think on the surface would hold somebody back, but they really don't.
Yeah, because there's all amazing, especially with technology today, right? The tools you can cobble together to make lots of things that you didn't think would be able to be happening happen. It's just tremendous.
And there's roles that these individuals can do, because while they may have a disability in one area, they have an ability in another. And it's matching those things up that are critically important.
And it makes magic happen, right?
It does.
So I love that. I want to thank you for doing this. I mean, you're still early in your amazing career to come. Obviously, it'll be interesting to see what happens with, you know, rates this year. And, you know, we're all running through another cycle, but that's okay. That's where we actually, you know, pivot, dive in, learn new ways to do things, ask a lot of questions, right? Everything that you're saying. And we get through it and we're better from it. We learn a lot. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, John. It was a real pleasure today. Great to see you.
What a great story. Keep going, man. Keep doing it.
Thanks, my friend.
Hi, John Schultz here. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode. Would really appreciate it if you would like, comment, subscribe, and share with your friends. Looking forward to being with you soon.